kind of what keeps me going, is that I know that there's little girls in the stand when it's not COVID, you know, or when it is, little girls watching me on TV, and I don't want to disappoint them. And that doesn't necessarily mean I'll disappoint them if I don't win. It means that I set a good example for them. I'm a role model for them. I give them the opportunity to see someone with a disability who is doing something so much bigger than themselves, because I want to make sure that younger girls, especially with disabilities, to know that they can do something huge, and they don't have limitations, even if people try to place them on them or they try to place them on themselves. And I think that's my biggest why I do it for the younger girls, because growing up, I never had somebody with a disability to look up to. And so it's important for me to be that for somebody, even if it's just one person that I can impact. That's why I do the sport. That's why I do this, and that's why I keep doing it.
Today on the Running Anthropologist podcast, Jaylene Roberts, two-time Paralympic medalist and all-around wonderful competitor with great spirit and great advice to tell us about what the Paralympics is all about, as well as what it was like to be at the Tokyo Olympic Games and what she brought back with her. Not just her silver medal in the 100 meter and in the long jump, but a lot of international camaraderie and things to share, energy to carry forward to young people back home. She's 22 years old, doing her student teaching, and has so much training and hopes for the future ahead of her, but she also has a lot of wisdom to share with young athletes who may be in crossover sports, or may be differently abled, or may just be thinking, should I take a chance at trying something new? And her advice, I'm sure, will not disappoint. Stick with us. Let's get started. And I'm here today with Jaylene Roberts, who is recently returned from the Tokyo Paralympics 2020, now 2021. And I've been talking to her since her time there and followed her in all of her great Olympic competition. She is a long jumper and a 100 meter and 200 meter runner in Team USA's track and field. Thanks so much for your time and for being with us, Jaylene. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to talk.
Yeah, and I know that students in particular have a big part in your life, being a mentor to young athletes. Maybe we could start off by you telling me what you're doing today and what your life is like as an educator.
Yeah, so I'm currently finishing up my bachelor's degree in health and physical education to be a teacher. So yeah, just got done with, the beginning of my second week of student teaching. I work at a K-8 school, so I'm doing, elementary and middle school right now. Last quarter I worked with high schoolers, and so far it's been a great experience. So yeah, just looking forward to finishing up that degree and then, getting a teaching job, somewhere and getting started with that.
Well, any place I'm sure will be happy to have you. I've been following you for a while on social media and kind of got the opportunity to see how you've done just over the past couple of years at the World Championships, the Pan American Games, and now, of course, the Olympics. I guess just first off, what are your thoughts coming back from Tokyo? What was the experience like? You know, can you give kind of an umbrella statement about what it was like?
Yeah, when people ask me this, my initial thought is that it's indescribable, and I know that sounds so cliche, but I guess there's not really like one descriptive word or sentence that that can sum up the experience, but I think one feeling that I have coming back from it and going to there on the way there and back is kind of relief. Going there, I was so relieved and proud of myself for making it through all of the adversity that I had underwent from the time that I started training for the games. And it's so much buildup leading up to it. And then when you're there, you're at like this biggest stage competition of your life. And you're on such a high. And then when you come back, it's kind of weird getting adjusted to normal life again. And I think the one thing that people don't realize is that, like post-comp depression, post-comp blues is definitely a thing, because you're coming down from this incredible high that you don't feel every day. But yeah, no, it was definitely an incredible once in a lifetime experience, that hopefully won't be once in a lifetime for me, but just, figure of speech there.
Yeah, we hope so too. And especially, I know that you won medal, you won silver in both the 100 meter and the long jump. And frequently in track and field, people kind of, differentiate, they really specialize. So I want to ask you a little bit about, your journey to get to both of those and, how that happened. So let's start off with, just kind of your athlete roots. I know that you're from Washington State and sports were a big part of your life growing up. How did you find your way to events in track and field?
So I was always an athletic kid. My mom put me in recreational soccer at 4 years old, and I pretty much tried every sport. I tried soccer, t-ball, dance, cheerleading, and many more. And in fourth grade, I started running track in my elementary school, and that stuck with me all the way through high school and obviously until now. And it was in high school when I stuck to my three sports that I did all 4 years. I did soccer, wrestling, and track. And my junior year of high school, Washington State started the ambulatory division for high school track. And so my coaches wanted me to do it, and I kind of expressed to them that it wasn't something that I was comfortable doing just because my whole life I had only competed against able-bodied athletes. And I didn't want to highlight my disability as something that I've always seen as quote unquote normal, which I've learned now what is normal. There is no normal. So I told them that I wasn't really interested, and, they came back from the state track meet, and my high school, track coach actually came into my geography class, and he pulled me out and he said, "Hey, I met a couple Paralympic coaches. Do you know what that is?" And I said, "No, not really." And he kind of explained it to me and told me that they wanted to get connected with me. And I was up for it. I was like, "Yeah, sure." But, I had in my head that like, I wasn't going to be in any type of, adaptive competition. That's just not what I had wanted to do at that time. And so they had traveled down from Spokane with their team to come to me, and my coach had watched me run, and he immediately, before I could even agree to anything, called the head of U.S. Para Track and Field at the time, and told her that he is an athlete, that he found an athlete. And so they gave me the paperwork, and just that next year I was at my first international competition, and I was definitely very hesitant initially, which is very common for para athletes. I think it's just because it's something that a lot of people don't know about, and you don't know what you're getting yourself into. And I think my initial hesitation was that if I was going to compete in something new, I wanted there to be competition. And so as soon as I learned about the different classifications and that I would be competing against girls with my same disability and the same severity level, then I was a little more up to seeing what it was about. That's how I started track and field.
I can see how that would be, and that's very, that's incredibly remarkable and honorable for you to even think in that way. And I, like you said, I think probably most para athletes do the same. And that explains why there are so many different divisions that can sometimes be confusing for the non-involved observer that I've been learning about over the course of this Paralympics. Could you describe what those are like or how they... what kind of categories, just as examples, one might find in a track and field competition?
Yeah, so it actually, it took me a while to catch on, just because the classification numbers sometimes change. But they've been pretty consistent since I've started. But basically, so it starts at a low number. So it starts 11, 12, and 13 are all visually impaired classes. And the lower the number, the more severe the disability is. So an 11 would be a completely blind athlete, and they wear eyewear over their eyes to ensure that they can't see. And then 12 has more vision, and 13 has more vision. So that's kind of like the basis of it, is that whatever classification you're in, whatever number that is, the lower the number, the more severe. The higher the number, the less severe. So I am classed as a 37. So all of the 30s, I believe it goes, I know for sure it goes to 33. I don't know if it goes below that. It goes, I think from 33 to 38. 33 are athletes with cerebral palsy that race in race chairs, or they throw in throwing chairs. And then there's 38s that run, and 37 that run 36 and 35. So I am one below the least impaired class in the cerebral palsy classes. So I'm very high functioning. A lot of people don't know that I have a disability. They think that maybe I'm injured or ask why I'm limping. I'm pretty able for my class, but there's a class above me that's even more able than we are. That's kind of a little bit about how that works. In those other classifications too, there's short stature classifications. So for athletes with dwarfism, classifications for athletes that have any type of amputation, whether it be arm or leg, and then there's also classifications for wheelchair racers and seated throwers.
There's an incredible diversity. I didn't realize how many levels of cerebral palsy, especially. I actually grew up with someone in my family with cerebral palsy, and he did not have those competition options where we were located. But obviously there was community around, support and opportunities for him to do recreational things. So the question that I had for you was, in a lot of towns there aren't clubs, and universities may not have Paralympic training or para training. So how does, say, a young person go about finding and getting involved with a club or a sport that they might be able to compete in the future?
Yeah, no, it's a great question, because as a child, I didn't know, or my mom didn't know. I didn't even think that those, like, we didn't think that those existed, I don't think, or didn't know they existed, I guess. I would simply, if I knew what I knew now, just look up adaptive sports programs, and they're not always going to be near you, but there's programs and there's adaptive coaches or people in the adaptive world that can help connect younger athletes to resources. That's why I try to be so active on social media too, because I have a lot of parents of young athletes that reach out to me, and they're not always in my area that I live in, but there's different connections I know around the U.S. and maybe I can't, don't have one right in their city, but there's one that's like a state away as opposed to from the East Coast to the West Coast.
Sure.
And look up adaptive sports programs. Any athletes in the para world, are more than willing to help people get involved. That's one of my purposes of being a Paralympic athlete, is to just raise awareness about it, because had I known about it when I was younger, I wouldn't have a chance to get involved at a younger age. And thank God I'm still young. I still haven't reached my peak yet, but I love seeing young athletes come in and getting to see their growth over the years, and starting at a smaller adaptive sports club in their city, and then going all the way up into Paralympic Games is incredible. But yeah, that's why I'm so vocal on social media, and I know that my coaches do a lot of recruiting, going into schools and whatnot. And even if I see someone around the city, or a couple of my students have had cerebral palsy, I can spot that from a mile away. I have a pamphlet. I just give it to them to talk to them a little bit. And I also have an understanding that they are going to be hesitant, just because it's completely normal for that to be the case. But yeah, my thing is just try it once, you know. I didn't know what was going to happen when I got out of my comfort zone. If I had known that, I probably would have got out of it a little sooner.
That's amazing.
But better late than never.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think everyone appreciates the work that you're doing, and many of your friends that were in the Paralympics that I've seen you share with and, you know, share that experience with. It's so inspirational and motivational, as you said, for other young athletes. And as you mentioned, there are so many, we're all differently abled, but there are so many young people that are not able to participate fully in traditional sports, that they would like to. I know, for example, you have been able to do, you also love wrestling, and you've been able to do that at a competitive level, in regular competition as well. How did you get involved with that, and how does that, I don't know, mentally or philosophically play into your running and your jumping?
So I, in seventh grade, I tried out for the basketball team, and I made the team, but I'm almost positive it was not because of my skill set for basketball. It was because of my speed and my conditioning. I joined the team, and I could not pick up the game of basketball. I just couldn't pick it up. And so, a lot of the season and a lot of the time I was benched, and I'm the type of person that like wants to move. I want to be active. I want to move. I want to play. And I just wasn't getting that with basketball. And so after the season was over, one of my female classmates told me that she was going to wrestle, and I was like, yeah, right. No, you're not. And she's like, no, I am. And I was like, okay, cool. Like, I'm going to do it too. So I'm pretty sure like that same day I went home and I told my mom, I was like, mom, I want to do wrestling. And she was like fully supportive of it. Not knowing much about the sport. But then, yeah, I started in eighth grade, and I was really good. I think it boosted my confidence a little bit because I was able to beat some of the boys. And that gave me a little bit of recognition from my teammates and from my school and whatnot. And then when I got up to the high school level, I only wrestled against girls. I mean, I wrestled against a couple boys, and in practice I did, because I think that it helped me. But yeah, so initially my plan was to go to college for wrestling. I actually got recruitment letters from a couple different schools. And that was also right around the time when I met my Paralympic coach, and I just knew that it was a better opportunity. And I didn't really like one more than the other. I loved wrestling and I loved track, and I think they're both very different, but I definitely think that wrestling is one of the most like mental sports there is. I mean, obviously you have to be physically ready to compete and to wrestle a 6-minute match. And to be exhausted, but you also have to be mentally tough. And I think that's helped me a lot, just with conditioning phases of track and the long days, the early mornings, all of that. I had to get up super early for wrestling tournaments, and they would last all day. And it taught me too. So much of my time was devoted to wrestling. We wrestled, we practiced every day. And on the weekends we had a tournament. We wrestled over holidays, not on the actual holidays, but over holiday breaks we wrestled. We had to sacrifice a lot of things if we had to cut weight, and it was never substantial amounts because we're in high school. But if we had to cut a couple pounds, you know, like, we couldn't always enjoy a full Thanksgiving dinner or Thanksgiving leftovers or same thing with Christmas. And for track, I've had to sacrifice a lot of things too, different things, but you know, I moved 4 hours away to go train with my my Paralympic coach, which I'm slowly transitioning out of because I just recently moved to San Diego. But I moved 4 hours away from my friends and family. You know, I changed my nutritional habits. Sometimes you got to go to practice instead of going out with your friends, you know. But I think wrestling, as well as just being an athlete in general, in high school prepared me pretty well. And obviously there's some differences between being a high school athlete and an elite athlete, but there's definitely also some crossover in that.
Yeah, and a lot of crossover. I hear that often, that mental state, that willingness to give to the sport and kind of knowing what's required to be competitive. I think you're right. I think that overlaps a lot. And so from my understanding, let's take a step back, and if I can take you back just about 2 weeks now, what was that like, you know, knowing that all these other athletes, how much sacrifice and work they had put in, regardless of their abilities and what category they're in? What was that like to be with them on the track in Tokyo and in the Olympic Village from all over the world? What was that experience like?
Yeah, I love it. I adore the Chinese athletes, especially when I compete against her in long jump and the races.
Okay.
But yeah, so there's definitely a big language barrier there. But when we were waiting to get our medals for long jump, there was one of the volunteers there. She spoke Chinese fluently, and so she was kind of being our interpreter. We didn't ask her to, but she saw us kind of using translate and like trying to understand each other with gestures and whatnot. And yeah, I have like total respect for her. She's the most respectful competitor I've had. She always has a smile on her face. She's encouraging, even though she's my competitor. And just learning a little bit about how like their training structure. I just know they work so hard, and it's like they dedicate a lot. They have a lot of dedication they put into it and hard work. And so it's really cool getting to see other athletes there. And even I thought it was a really cool experience to get to communicate with each other as best we could, just whether it be about track or I know like. I was FaceTiming my mom, and I was telling her, like, this is my mom, and she was saying hi. So it's cool to get to connect with all the different athletes and different cultures. But yeah, no, I always commend my competitors because I know that they've been putting in the same amount of work. And yeah, it's just a cool thing to see it all come together for everybody.
There's this, I guess the U.S. had one of the bigger delegations. I know Japan had the biggest, and then China, of course, had a big delegation, and RPC. And I also saw this year was historic in that it was the most overall competitors and the most females that have ever competed in Paralympics and Olympics. So that, you know, I mean, that had to just be, even during the COVID pandemic, that had to be something special to witness and to come into the, you know, the ceremonies with that you know, that energy for the Paralympics.
That's always super cool to witness like female athletes and female leaders, female participants, just because I feel like a lot of times we're pretty underrepresented, and I think people do a good job of, I know, like, even this year, I've noticed, like, an article came out around Desert Challenge, around the time of Desert Challenge, and it was like eight women to watch at the U.S. Paralympic Trials. Just like little things like that that like mean a ton. It like makes speaking for myself, I think that it makes us feel seen more. So that's always really cool to see to see us being represented, and to like we are competitive, we are athletes as well.
Now, you know, one thing that I'm curious about, and I don't know exactly how this works, but there's some kind of a transition between the Olympics and the Paralympics. They're both the Olympic Games, but is there a lot of time between them? Do you overlap? Do you meet each other, or is it totally totally separate timeline?
No, it is a separate timeline. So the Olympics occur 2 weeks prior to the Paralympic Games. So there's like a 2 week gap in between. So the Olympic athletes come into Japan, they go to the village, they go to the stadium, and then after they're done, 2 weeks later, we come in. But everything Paralympics is, it's parallel. So parallel to the Olympics. So we have the same venue. So when we went, we have the same training venue, the same, obviously, Olympic and Paralympic stadium, the same village. We stay in the same village, same food, same everything. We even recently got the same pay as the Olympians. So we don't cross over. Like, we don't get to see each other, like, physically. But we do experience the same thing, just different personnel.
That's awesome, as it should be. Put in just as much work, and the competition is just as tough. I know there's another, you know, whatever percent, half or more of your life that is not competing in Paralympics, but I'm sure it seemed like the majority of your life leading up to the Paralympics. Does that feel, you mentioned this when we first started talking, does that feel like a monumental shift for you now going into student teaching? Are you still competing? Are you connecting with a new club in San Diego? What is all that like for you?
So I kind of had my plan prior to going to the games. So I just transitioned and moved to San Diego. I'm doing my last student teaching quarter here. And I've connected with one of the coaches at the Chula Vista Elite Athletic Training Center. So I will be training there. I'm just taking some time off. I think we'll restart here back in a little bit. Next I'll be training for the World Championships in Kobe. So we're back to Japan next year. And then after that year, we have a World Championships and a pair of Pan American Games.
Okay.
And then it'll be Paris again. So yeah, training will go on.
That's awesome. And I know that you've also meddled in a lot of other games outside of the Paralympics, because competitions go on every year. A lot of people don't realize, for example, you're a gold medalist in the 4x100 universal relay in 2019 for the World Championships. What I wanted to ask you about that. What is entailed in the universal relay?
So the universal relay is, or some people call it the mixed relay. So there are four athletes, just like a standard relay. The first leg has to be a visually impaired athlete. The second leg has to be a amputee. The third leg is an athlete with cerebral palsy. And the fourth leg is a wheelchair racer. So it has to be two girls and two guys. It does not matter the order of the genders, but it has to be two girls and two guys. And then rather than having batons, because let's say someone's an arm amputee and they can't hold a baton, we simply just tap each other, and that represents the handoff. That was an incredible race. That race is always so much fun. This year, they selected a different team, a new team for the games. But I'm glad I got to be a part of it when it first started, because I got to be on the first universal relay team that we've had. So that was an incredible experience.
That's awesome. Yeah, from what I gather, it's relatively new. So 2019 was the debut of international competition, and then this was the Paralympic debut.
Yes.
Okay, got it. It was beautiful to watch. I haven't seen your gold medal performance, but of course I did see the one in the Paralympic competition just a few weeks ago. And you're right, it feels really uniting, hence the term, I guess.
Yeah, it definitely is something that, it was just a great race to watch too. I made sure that I was at the stadium when that race went on. It was a really, really fun race to watch. And of course I know that the participants too had a lot of fun, and it's fun after the race all getting to come together and take pictures and talk about it. You talk about it all night. Oh my God, did you know this happened? Yeah, it's super cool. It's a super fun experience. I'm glad that some of the other athletes got to experience that as well.
I bet. Yeah, no, that's awesome. And I can't say enough how grateful I am that you're out there and you're sharing what you're sharing and doing what you're doing. I hope you get to continue it for many years as a teacher. One of the last questions I wanted to ask you was about that. You'd mentioned, and this is the case for non-disabled athletes as well, it's pretty rare that you find an athlete who can do that full-time, can be a professional athlete full-time. Most everyone has other jobs that support their training. How do you see that combination working for you? Do you think there's enough time for you to keep training when you start full-time teaching? Are there some resources that help you to, you know, be able to do both and make that transition?
So, I mean, right now my schedule is pretty busy. I'm not training right now because we just got back from the games. But I do student teach full-time, and I do also work. And so when I do start training again, I know that my job is willing to be flexible. When I find jobs, I'm very upfront, and anybody that knows me really well knows that my priorities are track, school, and then work. So all the jobs that I've had have been super accommodating for that, and fully supportive of what I do and excited about that. And so they're always willing to work with me. If I train in the morning, then they'll give me a night shift or whatnot. And they're also willing to give me time off if I have a competition or if I have some kind of media gig that I need to go to. So after these 3 months of student teaching, I won't be teaching anymore. So I'll just be working, and that'll open up my schedule a lot. As far as just not having to move too many things around for training. But yeah, I've always figured out a way to make it work. I've been doing it since 2017. And I don't really mind it. I am pretty busy. But I think that helps me stay focused. I don't have too much time to do other things that aren't beneficial to my training, you know? And I don't have any time to build any bad habits. I have time to, you know, try new places to eat or go to the beach and things like that. But just the right amount of time. I don't need too much free time in my schedule. I like it like that. I choose that for myself.
That's awesome. Well, you'll have a little bit more tempting weather this year in San Diego than you have growing up in Washington.
Yeah. I have talked to my best friend and roommate about that. Just getting off of work and being like, hey, you want to go to the beach casually? Can't do that in Washington, so.
Yeah, well, that's awesome. I wish you the best of luck. And I would like to close with this question about, I always ask about what advice you would give to younger athletes. And in particular, what has kept you going and helped you to move past obstacles? You know, if it's a quote or an idea or kind of a mantra that you try to live by and train by.
Yeah, my biggest piece of advice in just a short sentence would just be take a chance, because that was the hardest thing for me in getting involved with track. I didn't want to take a chance, and I was really stubborn, and I took a chance, and I got out of my comfort zone, and there was so much magic that happened, and I think that more people just need to take a chance. Take that first step, and I think that everything else will fall into place exactly how it should. And And maybe it's not for everybody, but what does it hurt to try, you know? So I think that would be my biggest piece of advice. And I guess my kind of what keeps me going is that I know that there's little girls in the stand when it's not COVID, you know, or when it is, little girls watching me on TV, and I don't want to disappoint them. And that doesn't necessarily mean I'll disappoint them if I don't win. It means that I set a good example for them. I'm a role model for them. I give them the opportunity to see someone with a disability who is doing something so much bigger than themselves, because I want to make sure that younger girls, especially with disabilities, to know that they can do something huge, and they don't have limitations, even if people try to place them on them or they try to place them on themselves. And I think that's my biggest why I do it for the younger girls, because growing up, I never had somebody with a disability to look up to. And so it's important for me to be that for somebody, even if it's just one person that I can impact. That's why I do the sport. That's why I do this, and that's why I keep doing it.
Well, that you are and that you do. And wise words from Jalene Roberts there. I'm so grateful for your time and grateful that you took a chance and also took a chance to share with us on the Running Anthropologist about everything, about your journey. And we hope to keep in touch with you and see all the great things that you're doing in the future, both in competition and in teaching. Thanks so much, Jalene.
Yes, thank you so much.
All right. And happy running.
Thank you.
And thank you so much for joining us for this Running Anthropologist episode. You can find show notes and more information about Jalene and the Paralympics on our blog site, runninganthropologist.com. And please connect with us. Follow us on social media if you're still on Facebook, or if you are on Instagram. That's Running Anthropologist. And definitely check out Jalene, who's also on Instagram. Has a lot of very inspiring things there. This episode, I think, really, really gets us moving forward with some momentum, some advice, some great ideas that give us inspiration for future movement. One of those organizations out there is Team for Kids. And in the next episode, I'll be interviewing folks that are running for that charity and supporting through New York City Marathon and across the country. Team for Kids provides venues and resources for coaches, for teachers, anyone that can help get kids moving and out there running, the running shoes, the races, all that good stuff. I can't wait to tell you about it and about my experience coming up with the virtual New York City Marathon and fundraising for Team for Kids. I'll share that in our show notes as well, and can't wait to see you next time. Till then, happy running.